the podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 50 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? 50 episodes. Sounds like that's worth a little celebration. Maybe I'll go buy cake later on at Cake Monkey. If you're ever in LA, go to Cake Monkey. They do good cakes. And you have some cake too, wherever you are, and we'll all pretend we're having cake together. Cake. Good cake. Anyway, today I'm interviewing Joe Arscott, and the reason I wanted to interview Joe is, there are lots of reasons, but let me just tell you that when you're looking to find people to interview in, you know, advertising in the last 20, 30, 40 years, the people you end up gravitating towards are white middle-aged men. They are. There's more of them who have had significant careers in advertising. And we can talk about why that is and what's wrong with that as much as we like. But that's the case. And you know, if you look back through the interviews I've done, I very deliberately tried to seek out particularly women at the beginning. And then, you know, there aren't as many creatives of color who have been had hugely successful careers in this industry. So I was talking to Hugh Todd over the Christmas break, and he said, you should interview Joe Arscott, because Joe has had a very unusual career for lots of reasons. And she breaks the white middle-aged man thing brilliantly by being a non-white, I don't know if you call him middle-aged, but all the diversity demographic boxes are kind of ticked by her. She is a woman of color, and she went from growing up with a white family in a small holding in Gloucestershire to joining the advertising industry in her late teens, in the mid-80s. So we're talking about this now in 2017. You're like, oh, we've got to sort this out. We've got to fix this. Joe was just jumped on in there in the mid-80s. And that was when it was so weird, it wasn't even a conversation. People weren't talking about diversity then because, well, I don't know, if you didn't grow up in the 80s, yeah, no, it was, you know, borderline casual racism wasn't such a frowned upon thing then. It was, you know, a lot of stuff has happened since then. So Joe, you know, forged her path then. And what you'll get is this sense that I very much got, that she is a relentlessly positive person. Nothing could have held her back from anything she wanted to do, judging by her character. And yeah, she just broke on in. And not only that, she was one of the forerunners of the advertising discipline called integrated. And if you've just joined advertising, say in the last 5 or 10 years ago, what's integrated? Well, integrated, you know, because every campaign we do now is integrated. You know, it's got to have a Facebook feed and social media experiential, some TV and some print and whatever. It's going to be 360. Well, Joe is a forerunner of that, because back in the day, that wasn't a thing. You know, doing a campaign in several media wasn't a thing. So she was one of the forerunners of that. Went to work all over America in all sorts of different places. We discussed that. It's quite interesting. And then did the same in the Middle East and really forged a path of her own. It's a very, very unusual career that she's had. But we talk about the whole multiculturalism and diversity debate at the end of what she says. And you'll find what she has to say very, very interesting, because, you know, we often hear from white people in this, probably white middle-aged men, in fact, in these conversations. And the voices of people of color, because they're fewer and further between, don't get heard quite as much. And if you want to hear some of them, or if you want to hear one of them, rather, just carry on listening to this podcast, which is very interesting and from a very different perspective. So enjoy your cake. And here's my chat with Joe.
Hi, Joe. Thanks a lot for making the time to chat with me today.
Hey, thanks very much. Really looking forward to this.
Me too. Again, like what I normally do is talk about people's backgrounds, and you have a somewhat unusual background that goes from being, you know, was it on a farm in Wales or in a village?
In Gloucestershire.
Okay. Yeah. You know, and I don't know how much you want to go into this, but, you know, just so people know the background, you didn't really know your mum and dad, and you ended up with this family in Gloucestershire. You know, how do you think that it kind of informed the way things were for you as a kid?
Well, I think I didn't see my colour. I mean, I didn't realise I was black, so I was adopted into a mixed race, African white, and I was adopted into a white family, thank goodness, in the 60s. Wasn't a thing that happened often. And I never saw my colour. You know, I think I was 8, and, you know, when I realised I was actually black, I remember the moment looking in the mirror and going, oh my God, I'm black. Literally, it's like a self-awareness phase where it hits you. And, you know, I grew up in the country, and we grew up on a small holding, and the school was a rural school. So I was lamb monitor and chicken monitor and rabbit monitor, and I loved it. And of course, advertising wasn't on anyone's consciousness in the mid-80s, definitely not in Gloucestershire. I found out about it actually because of the rain. I put it because of the rain, because it was raining. So I became the school librarian, which meant I could look at the books at lunchtime. And then I saw copywriting. I always knew I was a writer and I had an imagination and I wanted to be a journalist, ideally. But I went to the local paper and the editor asked me 3 political questions and I couldn't answer one because I only read the Gloucester Citizen. And then, you know, I didn't know what else to do. And I saw copywriting. I thought, that looks interesting. It's still writing. You can use your imagination, which I knew I had a vivid one. And I approached an agency in London in those days called CDP, call it Dickinson Pierce, and the ECD was Dave Brown, who I took a load of pencil scribbles to when I was 17.
Wow.
Got the coach up from Gloucestershire and said, I want to be an advertiser. I want to be a writer. And he kind of held his breath and kind of tried not to laugh and was very kind and went, you need to go to Watford College. And that's how I heard about Watford College. And I applied and that's where I ended up in 85, 86.
So was Tony in charge then, or who was leading the course then?
It was the year before Tony arrived. So it was Maureen Paulbrook, who I think was only there a couple of years. She was an amazing, amazing woman, a Scottish woman. And I think Roland Houghton Richter at VCCP was in my year as well, and Graham Pugh. And so I was with Maureen's year, and it was before the course got incredibly sophisticated. You know, we're still in kind of typewriters and Tippex kind of era, well before computers. But it was amazing. As I said, 8 months, and then you're out in an agency. It was brilliant. It was amazing.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, oh my God, like the mid-80s for advertising and for Britain was a very, very different time to how it was even 10 years later. So, you know, I think there was a sort of knowledge of the sort of glossy, wear your braces, Saatchi & Saatchi kind of world of advertising then. Were you aware of that, and were you into it, or were you repulsed by it, or was it something that didn't really connect in that way?
Good question. I was aware of it because I was looking for role models. Being mixed race in a white community, I was always looking for role models. And mine, don't judge me, were Margaret Thatcher and Boy George. Margaret Thatcher because she was a strong woman in a male environment, and Boy George just because he was weird and creative and could be who he wanted to be. And when I moved into the advertising circles, it was very much the champagne era, the Filer Fax era, earn more than your age, which when you're 18, it was still a big deal when 7 grand was your starting salary. it was all about flashy champagne and Kettners and having a wonderful time. And I'm really glad I experienced that before the recession, of course. I'm so glad. And I was aware of it and I loved it. I was young. I was 19, 20, and I was living the life, literally living the life. I thought, this is it. This is where I've always meant to be. And the advertising was so smart. You know, it was things about The Economist and Silk Cut, and you would literally wait for the latest billboard to come out. You know, it was very strong and writing heavy and crafted heavy and about the ideas. I loved it.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting what you're also saying about, you know, having role models and they're not being, I mean, we can talk about this a bit later on because, I mean, one of the main reasons I wanted to talk to you was to have the perspective of someone who may have gone through the industry in a slightly different way. But, you know, do you think it's important that there's that phrase that, you know, you can't be it unless you see it or something like that? And do you feel like the fact that there aren't as many leaders from minorities in advertising, was that an odd thing for you in the 80s, or was it just hey, fine, I'm just going to get on with it?
No, do you know what? It really wasn't an issue. For me, I would just go for interviews and I would expect to have that 2 second silence when a creative leader would look at me and kind of go, oh my God, she's black. Oh my God, she's a girl. You know, I was a double whammy. And then you got used to it, it disappeared, and then you just got hired for your talent. So for me, I'll be completely honest, my colour and being a girl was absolutely never really an issue. You got used to be the only one. This was the days of when Dave Trott, of course, had GGT on Dean Street. These are the days of Ladettes. So most girls, if you were in the industry, in the creative side, turned into Ladettes. They wore jeans, they cut their hair short, they drank beer. They played pool and snooker because that was what it was all about, and drinking all afternoon. I was the same, but I would wear my hair long, feather boas and ball gowns. I thought, I'm not changing for you lot. I'm not changing for you. I am who I am. And that's why I loved advertising, because it let you be you. It was an incredible time, but it still is. I still love it because it lets you be you. It's just different now.
Yeah. I guess it is different. So, you know, where did you kind of, where did the career sort of begin in terms of, you know, entering the advertising industry?
Well, I think for me, the word career didn't even exist. I just got a job as a copywriter. I mean, my entry, I had a placement at DMB&B, which doesn't exist anymore, which is incredibly strange to this day, I still think.
Yeah.
And then just went from agency to agency. But I always went to global network agencies. Like, I was in Ogilvy Business for a while. I was in a sales promotion, Wondermans, when it was direct marketing for a while. I did all these weird little things, but in good agencies. So I learned them well. And I never realized that in the end, that would actually be the best thing that ever happened to me. Because when an integration began to come in, as in creatives who could do all media, I could do it because I'd actually worked solidly in those agencies. I didn't just talk it. And I was very lucky. I mean, my role models, my friends were people like Trevor Beattie, who I know you've spoken to. And, you know, so I looked up to people who inspired me, and I would always go for the odds. So Trevor was a great friend, and I admired him when we're talking about role models, because he was like this mad guy with mad hair who just did what he wanted, had a weird Birmingham accent and did amazing creative work. And he was so inspirational, and he had a voice and so much kind of PR. And I very much kind of followed the way he did things. I mean, during that time, I had a strong presence in the press with him, just as having an opinion about integration. And I believed integration could exist because the industry was so split above the line, below the line. And I just love people like him and Graham Fink, who could throw TVs out of, you know, Saatchi windows. I like people who like to stir things up a bit. You could be yourself. That's what I loved about advertising. Dream job. It still was. And do you know what? It still is. Loved it. Love it.
Yeah. Do you think that was more not accepted back in those days, but more like a thing, whether it was Graham or Trevor or what you're talking about, wearing feather boas and ball gowns or whatever. I don't know if the industry is as embracing of what people sometimes refer to as characters these days as it was then.
I think it was a sign of the times. It was kind of excess, kind of 80s. It definitely was a sign of the times of kind of indulgence and very much self-awareness. I guess the beginning of the celebrity era in advertising, so to speak, or the you know, the continuance of it. So, yes, I think it was a unique time. I think celebrities don't exist as much because I think people don't follow the craft as much anymore. You know, we used to like wait for our copy of the campaign, wait for the news, meet every week in the pubs. The competition between agencies and between creatives, you knew everybody's name and what was going on. And it was a thrill. It was exciting. And it was also all based around the same area, of course. It was all based around Soho. So it was a real community, not obviously just with advertising, but with, you know, the producers and the film and everything around it. It was an incredible time. And today is different. I mean, I'm not young. Sure, if I was 18 years old in the industry now, they would say it's you still have your role models. But it's a different industry. It is a different industry now.
And do you think the fragmentation of media is something that's done that? Because I've got a theory in the back of my mind that, you know, when advertising was press and posters and TV, you got in the back of a cab, and if someone said, what have you done? You're in advertising, what have you done? You could tell them, and there was a decent chance they'd know. But if you've done a microsite for an event that happened in Belgium or something like that, they're not going to know. And I wonder if that in some way has sort of affected advertising in terms of its standing and its fame as a sort of something that's talked about in the general public.
I agree with you. I think it's definitely different in that respect. I mean, you just turn on, I've traveled all over the world, and you come back to England after being away for many years, and you turn the TV on and it's like, where are the good TV commercials? You go down the underground, it's like, where are the great posters? Of course, some are still there. Of course they are, but it is not the same. It used to be a craft and an art. Digital's changed things. I mean, let's be honest. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's evolution. But digital has just changed the whole perception of what advertising is and what being a creative is.
Yeah, absolutely. And just going back to your career at this stage, I believe next was Draft, where you did, I mean, the thing I was most aware, because I knew of your name and some of your work, even when I was starting off, I started in the mid-90s, and the poster you did for Asthma, which was sort of made with glue. I wonder, I'm going to put that up so people will be able to see it. Could you talk about that a little bit? How did it come about, and how did it happen? Did you know it was something that you could feasibly do physically, in terms of how it was going to work?
No, but that was a time, I was at Saatchi and Saatchi or Draft? I can't even remember, to be honest with you. I think it was Draft, but I think that was after or before Saatchi. It was during that era of nothing's impossible and be proactive. Right. You can make things happen. We approached the client. I think I was working with Chris Arnold at that stage. We approached the client. They wanted to do a leaflet, as all clients did, about things when they had no money. We said, let's do something else. We begged. We got the free media because we knew it would be PR. We approached CM to do this glue, which didn't exist. So they created the glue for it. And, you promised them, they would get PR to the story. So in the end, what we did was Foxhall Roundabout, it was a clear 96-sheet billboard, completely white. We got the press along. They're like, why have you brought us along for a clear billboard? We say, come back in 2 weeks. They didn't realise it'd been painted in clear glue. So all the air pollution stuck to it. And then that revealed the headline, this poster's been up for 2 weeks. Imagine what your lungs must look like. And it was for the National Asthma Campaign. But those were the days when if you didn't have the clients, you would find the clients. You would make the opportunities because it was all about awards. And when I was in England before I moved away, that's what it was all about. It was all about getting a Clio or a GAD. I'm not saying it's different now, but your reason of being in the industry, your self-esteem came from the awards. And it's only going globally, my perspective on advertising completely changed.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's also, there's a time of your career, I was talking to someone about this earlier this week, where when you're young, awards are much more important because as something that can give you raises and promotions and profile in the industry, then it's something that it's almost like you want to get that car started, give it a bit of a turbo boost. Whereas once the car's already going, you don't need it so much and it's not quite so important. Yeah. So I think that might be part of it too.
Absolutely.
But then after Draft, you ended up being a drama producer for BBC Wales. Now, that's a little bit weird. And I think what that reminds me of is my chat with Chaka Sabani, the fact that she seemed to have gone between the two industries a little bit as well. But you were the pace setter there. You started that off. How and why did that happen?
I love Chaka. Yes. Basically, I'd left Draft because they didn't want to go integrated. They were integrated. We were winning DNADs and all the awards. And they said they wanted to go back to pure direct mail, which is what they are in the States. And I didn't agree with that. It wasn't what I wanted. It was my first joint creative directorship. So I walked and I thought, I'm going to leave the industry because the industry was saying integration doesn't exist. It can't happen. And I knew in my heart it could. I knew you could have ideas that go across all media. And I actually went and met Rory Sutherland at Ogilvy. And he said, you know what? go to our agency in Paris, don't leave the industry, go and have a break, go and work freelance there for a while. So I went with Kevin Ferry, who's just gone to Thailand, actually, I think, Ogilvy. And we went and worked in Paris for a few months. And while I was out there, I'd always done other writing. That was the great thing about advertising, I think, is it allows you to do all your other dreams. Like, I'd always done journalism for Creative Review and Soho Runner, that doesn't exist anymore. I'd always written scripts for the BBC and stuff. And Carl Francis, who was head of the BBC at the time, drama, basically said, come and be a drama producer. I said, I don't know anything about being a drama producer. He says, it's like a commercial, but bigger. So I went, okay. So I left Paris and went to the BBC, where I worked on a series of dramas, helping write scripts, produce them, went to Hollywood to cast a couple of movies. Wow. But it was slow. After advertising, it was slow, and it wasn't as creative as I thought it would be, a drama department. It was very, I guess, again, a sign of the times. And then I got a call from a headhunter in London who said, because life was ruled by headhunters in those days, it was before digital, looking for jobs. And the headhunter called me, Nita Dixon, and said, advertising as you see it, Joe, integration, it's happening. There's an agency in London, I've spoken to them about you, and they want to meet you. And then that was Saatchi & Saatchi. So I went and met Gary Sharpen, who was heading up integration. And then Dave Droger came in, and gosh, I stayed there for 4 years. I probably could have stayed there forever. It was like the most amazing time. And that completely changed me as a creative.
Yeah, this might be weird for anyone listening who's perhaps, I don't know what age it would be confusing for, but the idea that integration was a thing back in those days, you know, being an integrated creative director, you're like, well, you know, isn't everything integrated now? So how was it in those days in terms of bringing people from, I guess, what was non-integration into integration? Mm-hmm. How did that happen?
Slowly. And it actually came from the below the line. It actually came from direct marketing upwards rather than the other way around.
Right.
There were creative directors like Steve Aldridge, John Townsend, myself, who were kind of thought leaders in it, because we could, I don't know, I think we were freer to see it. I think the training from going below up was less restrictive in our minds. And I just went to Droger one day and said, look, listen, you've got a whole department here of integrated creatives. He was amazing. We were all treated the same, had the same offices. It was completely amazing. And I said, we can do the same briefs all the way through. And he said, well, choose a brief and then let's do it. So I chose a brief, a P&G brief, and everyone above or below had the same brief. And an integrated team basically won it, did the best. And then Droger completely opened up the department. He was so open-minded when it came to that, you know, ideas. And the whole philosophy of nothing is impossible, and digital was coming in at that point. That was an amazing time. I mean, the Droger era at Saatchi, I think everybody talks about it. It was kind of like an infamous time, if you like, for being a creative under leadership like that. I think it changed a lot of creatives' perspectives on how they work.
Yeah, and two of the most recent interviews I did, with both with Hugh and with Cam Blackley, they both worked under Dave at various points and obviously speak very highly of him. I don't know if there was anything specific you wanted to say about him other than how great he was. Were there any particular occasions where you saw that greatness?
I think for me, it was just how he would make you feel as a creative. I mean, he was my second report. So Gary Sharpen was my boss, and he was obviously the ECD. And for me, it was in digital, we're on the bottom floor. And I think this was stupid. We were working on Toyota at that point, and we were doing banner ads, which were the hottest new thing. And I said, it's so silly they're being done two floors below. Why aren't we all up here working together? I said, can I be a contact? Can I be a creative lead in charge of digital and bringing it up to the creative floor and go to their meetings and their status meetings? And Dave's like, yeah. And then 2 minutes later, I'm like, you know, we're not integrated enough. Can I be a voice of the agency of that? And Dave's like, yeah. And his philosophy was, if you fail, I'll fire you. So of course you never fail. and that freedom to let a creative follow their instincts, I think that's what I really appreciated during that time, was he let you follow your instincts as an odd creative who would wear feather boas. He would trust in your instincts, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah, sounds great. So if it was so great, how and why did it come to an end?
I was there 4 years, and I was deputy integrated creative director, and he brought his friend Trevor Thomas over to lead the department. So I knew I would never be creative director because he just brought his friend over. And I really wanted to lead a department. I felt I was ready to be a creative director and have my own department. I actually kind of resigned twice from Saatchi's, but they'd never let you go. And I went to him and I said, okay, you know, this time I want to go. He goes, is the job better for you? And I said, I think so. He says, okay, then I won't ask you to stay. He says, I want you to stay, but I won't ask you. And so I left. And so I left to go to Bates, which, again, doesn't exist anymore. Bates 141 to integrate their department the way it happened at Saatchi's. And I absolutely loved it. My first time as a creative director, as a leader, creatives who are still my friends to this day. And it all ended abruptly within months because WPP bought the network and closed the agencies down.
Right.
It's like, great, I'm the happiest I've ever been and winning all these awards and life is fabulous and, oh, okay. And of course, I had the option. I could either go to Ogilvy and Mather or I could go to JWT within the merger. Neither were right for me for different reasons. So I took the payoff and left and thought, my goodness, what am I going to do with my life now? What am I going to do? And I thought, well, I'll take some time off. And I represented an adoption charity. And I was on GMTV, you know, morning breakfast TV, and talking about the charity. And I ended up in the green room getting in a conversation with the leader of the opposition, Michael Howard. Before I knew it, I was being groomed to be a member of bloody parliament for 8 months.
What, for the Conservative Party?
Yes.
I'm not saying that, I mean, obviously there's different opinions. And as someone who's inspired by Margaret Thatcher as a strong woman at the beginning of things, but it's funny actually, because I've just been back to England for a week, and I had lunch with a friend of mine, and he had been groomed to be in politics when he left school for the Labour Party, and he'd been fully in the Labour Party, and then he'd given it a miss for about 10 years and doing other things. And he said he was now a local councillor, and it didn't come out until later on in the conversation that he was now a Conservative local councillor. And I was like, whoa, how did that happen? So how far did your grooming process go from Michael Howard? Being groomed by Michael Howard sounds like a very interesting experience.
It was hilarious. And I was on a shoulder girl. So, I mean, I was always there, always around the campaign. You know, I was terrible. I said, but does it matter? This shows the state of the party at the time. And this is when I was first aware of my colour, so to speak.
Yeah.
I said, does it matter that I know nothing about politics? And I remember the lady at headquarters, the vice chairman, laughing and going, no, dear. You know, that's why we need you, because they'd met me. They knew I, you know, I could speak on TV. They knew I had a voice and everything. So they were willing to groom me. But yeah, what changed was basically I got the offer to go to America. And I thought, gosh, Coca-Cola, States, Atlanta, this is too good to miss. And that's when the change happened in 2006.
Great. So we can talk a little bit about what it's like to make that move, because I think you're quite a big advocate. I was reading your article in Campaign about going to another country and working there and shaking things up. What was that move like? And the context I want to put this in is I see, you know, a lot of black creative leaders in this country, way more proportionately and in numbers than I've ever seen in the UK. What did it feel like? You know, again, I don't know if your colour was ever an issue or ever interesting there or ever part of it, but it feels like maybe making that move and coming to another country, you know, you could see a whole different way that creativity and advertising was perceived, you know, whether through your race, your gender, or just through, you know, what you were working on.
I think all of the above, to be honest with you. I'd reached the top of where I could be in integration at that time. I was head of an agency. None of my friends were going to leave their jobs, and there was only five of us in integration. So I literally had nowhere to go at that point. And I really wondered what to do. And then when this opportunity came, basically it's because they knew I was integrated and it was just happening in the States, integration. They knew I was a good teacher because I was very good at transforming departments, which is something I'd learned from, just from watching Droga. And they knew I was great with clients. So that's why they poached me for Coca-Cola. So I went over, it was with Momentum Worldwide, McCann World Group. And I went over to Atlanta, that, you know, the agency was set up just for Coke. So it's literally in the shadow of the headquarters building. And baptism by fire is all I can say. I, looking back in retrospect, I think the fact that I was black had something to do with it, because I was incredibly naive. I didn't really know anything about America. You see about New York on TV, but that's all you kind of know. I'd never been to the American South, and suddenly, you know, they were very crafty. My interview was kind of like half a day in Atlanta, where they took you to a posh area, where I remember thinking, gosh, and this sounds really racist, and I don't mean it to sound racist, but the African-American community were very wealthy, and it was a very nice area, and I thought, this is different. There's more African-Americans, there's more black people, in inverted commas, than there are white people in this restaurant, and they're all wealthy. And then within half a day, they whisked me to New York. And then before I knew it, you know, the O-1 visa, before I had the O-1 visa, which took months, I was in the States, and I absolutely loved it. It was such an education. It transformed my life and my career ever since. And working in Atlanta was the perfect place to start as a creative, but also as a creative of color. I mean, one is Coca-Cola. So what you're going to learn working on Coca-Cola, especially when your first project is the Olympic Games, which is the biggest monster ever, and you're leading the agency council, and you've never done anything on this scale in your life, because trust me, there's nothing in London on the scale of leading a Coca-Cola headquarters Olympic Games. It's, especially when it's Beijing, China, it was just like gigantic. Working on agency councils with Mother and Wydens. Then you learn everything is new. Everything is new. The sports are new. Athletes. Suddenly you have to get in the American, you know, you're working with LeBron James and doing content for digital because it's coming in now and internet is doing really well. You're doing in-store, but stores you've never heard of, and everything's got a different word. And but then you get different brands within Coke. Obviously, you know, you got the Coke Classic and the Diet Coke, but you Sprite and Gatorade or whatever. But then also you've got Powerade, I should say. But then you've also got Sprite. And Sprite was interesting for me because it is an African-American Hispanic brand. And the client looked at me, who was African-American, Maurice. And I know he was looking at me going, they hired you because you were black and because you're obviously good and you're integrated. But you know nothing about being African-American. It's different. And I was so lucky because I could literally walk down the street in 20 minutes and sit on Martin Luther King's doorstep. I could go to Ebenezer Church. I could speak to people who knew him. I could go to America and go and hang out in bodegas and barbershops and go to Chicago, and where I knew the chief of police, and learn about. It was an education, and it's for the first time in my life, advertising wasn't about me. It was truly about helping and empowering communities and people. And it wasn't just about color. You know, you're dealing with NASCAR, which was Coke Zero, and then it's Middle America, and suddenly I'm going around racing tracks with NASCAR, and I loved it. Talk about baptism by fire and education and Momentum, of course. It wasn't just about retail, it's about experiences and phygital, that, you know, they invented that phrase.
Phygital?
Phygital.
What's phygital?
Physical and digital world brought
oh,
together.
Oh, right, okay.
It was an absolutely amazing time. But as a creative, I don't know if you've lived through it, but your life is in 3 years spans when you're on an O-1 visa, because it has to be renewed every 3 years. So that's when you decide, are you staying with the agency, do you move agency? And so my life has always kind of gone on visa timelines. But that time in Atlanta was absolutely incredible. Amazing.
Yeah, I could very boringly discuss my visa situation with you and with everyone else listening, but I'm not sure they're going to be interested in my self-sponsored green card application. But, you know, no, it's interesting because of having to re-up every 3 years, because I guess that's what made – partly made your time there 3 years, or did you feel like it was time to move on to a different challenge anyway?
Well, what happened, shopper marketing was just coming in. I'd realised by that time, I like to learn. You know, I'm a good student of advertising. I want to know, you know, and I think it's because I started off in direct marketing and sales promotion and then went to integrated and learned about above the line. But I was never purist above the line, you see. I never was. I was never with the Trevors and you probably, because I was always the integrated area of it. But I always loved to learn something new. And at that point, we were hiring, stealing people from Saatchi X, shopper marketing. And that was the new word, shopper marketing. And Coke had just set up a shopper marketing department. And I thought, gosh, you know, if they're stealing people from Saatchi X, I need to go and work for Saatchi X. I need to know what they know. So I literally picked up the phone and ended up speaking to Carlos Sanchez, who was the global creative director, and Doug Van Andel. And before I knew it, there I was in Bentonville, Arkansas, which again,
oh my God,
life is strange. Hey.
Yeah. So two things. What's shopper marketing, really? And what the hell is Bentonville? Did you say Arkansas? Bentonville. Yeah. What's that like?
Well, shopper marketing basically is psychology and anthropology. You know, when a creative usually gets a brief, it says, you know, the shopper is this woman, you know, 18 to 26, blah, and you do the work. With shopper marketing, it really is getting in the mindset of the shopper and understanding when's the best time to communicate with them. People are wrong when they think shopper marketing is just in the store. It ends up at store. You've got that 3 seconds at shelf. But to get them to store, you may be doing an event and a party. It may be a TV commercial. It may be a billboard. So it is integrated, if you like. But everything counts off that 3 seconds at shelf. So you really do have to understand the store and retailers and how different retailers work. So I love it. If you know, for my mind, it was a pure education, which I never appreciated until I went to Saatchi X. And the reason I went to Arkansas, which all my friends in the States and in the big cities were kind of going, you in Arkansas? Because Arkansas is very much the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
And it's very kind of small town America, Fayetteville. And I'm a big personality and I'm also a woman of colour. And we're talking about a particularly Ku Klux Klan is real. You know, we're talking about a certain area. I just thought, well, I'm sorry, I want to go there. P&G was the client for Walmart. So I'd be looking after Procter & Gamble, all their brands, just beauty at that point. And I'd always stayed away from beauty in England because girls don't do beauty. Your career's dead. But I felt comfortable then to do beauty for Walmart stores North America and globally. And I thought, well, that's going to be interesting. Loved it. What I learned from basically immediately with Coke, you're with the highest level clients. Obviously, it's their headquarters. And it's the same with Walmart and Procter & Gamble. You're suddenly, as a creative director, you're dealing at such a different level on a daily basis. And your issues aren't just creative issues. You have to understand the business issues. You can't be naive. You can't be a pampered, spoiled creative. And it's an absolutely amazing experience, again, where you learn about a whole other region of America, which is the middle America and the shoppers and the mums and the Hispanic community. Again, a whole other experience learning about the Hispanic community in the States. And again, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And I stayed there for 3 years and then got a transfer to their office in Chicago, where I stayed. And then I thought, okay, I need a break now. I'm not sure what to do. So I took my first long sabbatical, which I've heard people in the past talk about sabbaticals, creatives, and I think, gosh, how nice to be able to do that. And I was in that stage. I went back to Atlanta. And I went back to Atlanta for a year, rented a house with my cat and dog, and just relaxed over summer, which was amazing, was wondering what to do next.
Cool. And I guess I'm still slightly interested in going to Bentonville, Arkansas, only because culturally you've come from Soho through to even Atlanta, which is a big city, and then Bentonville. I've just looked it up on Wikipedia, so I didn't know this, but it's the ninth biggest city in Arkansas. And
if you actually look at Fayetteville, because that's where I actually was.
Stateville.
Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Fayetteville.
It's a college town, and that's important. Fayetteville town. It's all go Hogs. The college football. Everyone wears red on Sundays, even me. It was the most amazing time.
Well, I mean,
you can't imagine from a city girl to living in a college football town where, oh my God, you go to the rodeo. I loved going to the rodeo. I went to the rodeo. My first day in Arkansas, actually, I do have to say very quickly, was I sat outside Walmart getting supplies for my house. And first came up two cowboys, real cowboys with cowboy hats and Wrangler jeans. Real, they're real. Cowboys are real. And then 2 minutes later, up came Amish in their buggy. I'm going, oh my goodness, it's real. It's real. Yeah, you learn to get rid of your stereotypes pretty quickly and learn about humanity, I think, when you work around the States. That was a good education for me, which in England, I never would have had at that point.
Yeah, I think for most people in England, the perception of America is what they see through LA and New York and possibly Chicago, mm-hmm. and maybe Miami a little mm-hmm. bit as well. But the states in between, I drove from LA to New York and back with my family because we wanted to see the rest of America. And a lot of people I knew in California, some people have never left California, but there were plenty of people who definitely hadn't gone to those states in between. But that is the vast majority, at least geographically, of America. And, you know, if you want to find out what St. Louis, Missouri is like, you got to go to St. Louis, Missouri, and it's an amazing place. And
absolutely,
yeah.
Great museum up there as well. Amazing.
It's an amazing museum. Yeah, museum for children. It's great. But I think that goes back to this whole idea of going and seeing another part of the world. And you know, I'll put a link to that campaign article up on the blog post that accompanies this. But
thanks.
You know, I would always recommend to people that, you know, it took me 40 years to leave London really on a permanent basis, and it really just reinvigorates, or this is what it did for me anyway, reinvigorated my perspective on the world. Because everything you do is a normal habit, and you go, okay, I'm in England, I eat Marmite and Jaffa cakes and have a cup of tea and all this kind of stuff, and the weather's like this, and I get the bus and the tube, and it's like this. And when you're forced to change all those everyday things by going to another country, even one that speaks English and is fairly familiar to us all, like in America and LA, I think it just really jump starts your brain again, would be how I put it.
Completely. And in ways you never expect. I think when you're British, or I know I did when I looked at America, I never thought of moving there. It just happened. But when you look at America, it's just America. And it's only when you go there, as you said, you drove across it, which I'm jealous. You don't realize how big, and you don't realize how every state is a different country, with different shoppers and different consumers and different mindsets. And that's what changed my life, understanding that.
Absolutely. And just because we skip past it quite quickly, what was Chicago like for you?
Chicago, I am, and I still say it to this day, I'm the only person in the world who didn't fall in love with Chicago. Everybody loves Chicago. And I had an amazing apartment, looking over the river. You know, life, you know, my office, the agency was in the Merchandise Mart, an iconic building. Couldn't have been better positioned to have an amazing Chicago life, but I didn't connect. And I think emotionally connect, I mean. And I think that's simply because I'd come from the South. You know, I consider myself, even though I'm British, in America, I consider myself a Southerner. Of course, when I was working for Coke, our offices are also, you know, McCann offices, Momentum offices are also in New York. They're also in St. Louis. So you're traveling about. But I consider myself a Southerner. I love the lifestyle. I love the culture. I love the history. So Chicago, for me, has that. Of course, it has history and culture and amazing buildings. I did a great photo study of fire escapes, but I didn't connect with Chicago, so I left after a year. Didn't connect with the city, and that's important for me because I love my job, and I have to be emotionally involved, and if I'm not emotionally involved, then I can't commit in my heart, you know.
Sure So we've left you, I don't know, on your porch with your cat and dog in your sabbatical in Atlanta. What happens now?
Literally. Well, I come back to England. I think, okay, I've been out of the country 8 years. Maybe it's time, well, nearly 9 years. Maybe it's time to come back to England. So I do. I come back to England and I don't know where I fit anymore. Advertising's moved on. I didn't really do anything to promote myself when I was away. So even though I had a huge profile in PR when I left, when I came back, my friends and people knew me, but it wasn't the same. And I'll be honest with you, the key thing was the jobs, which were high profile jobs and great agencies I was talking to, didn't excite me. And I'm thinking, after I've seen the world, after I've done what I've done, it's very hard to come back. And it felt like a step backwards. And I just mean for me as a creative emotionally, it felt like a going back. I wasn't going to learn anything new that was going to excite me and set my heart on fire. So I've actually went into a bit of a depression, a bit despondent. I don't know where I fit. And I thought, well, where else in the world have I not seen? And out of the blue, before I knew it, there I was at JWT London, and JWT London meeting the global head of HR, kind of going, how do you fancy Dubai in the Middle East? Mina, we were interested in setting up a shop or a retail over there. I'm like, okay. And hence my step into the Middle East.
And what is Mina?
Middle East, North Africa.
Oh, Middle East, North Africa. Yeah, there's so many acronyms, BRIC and MEA. And, yeah, okay, just checking.
Totally. So basically, my role was to try and start up a shopper operation based in Dubai, but overseeing Saudi, Egypt, Iraq, etc., etc.
Okay. No, go on, go on.
Which, again, is pretty kind of strange. You've just come from the States, you know nothing about the Muslim culture. You probably have the preconceptions when you go there. And then suddenly, but you're open-minded because you've learned from the States that you've learned about different cultures and how every area is different. And before I went to Dubai, they did baptism by fire and they sent me to Qatar to work on a pitch with all the heads of JWT Middle East. And it was based on a billionaire's private island. So my first week at JWT was on a billionaire's private island. I'm going, well, this is okay.
Okay, so my perception of not having been to the Middle East really is not somewhere that I'm gagging to go. So could you tell me what Qatar's like, and could you tell me what it's like in general over there? I think, especially outside of the somewhat artificial atmosphere of Dubai, what's it like being there?
Well, I think take all your preconceptions and don't throw them away, because your preconceptions, as in people are covered, you know, there's rules. And it's baptism by fire. You know what advertising's like? They just place you in an agency, then the next day they place you in a hotel, and the next day you're in the agency. So you don't actually get training on how to be in the Middle East. So much of what you find out is online. I was on a pitch from a major cell phone company. So what I do when I do anything like that is I was doing the retail area. So I said, listen, I'm going to go and do some store walks. And everything's based in shopping malls, because you forget it's so hot in the Middle East that most stores are based in shopping malls because they're air conditioned.
Yeah.
So I went to the shopping mall with the lady with me, went, took photos, and you know, you don't take photos of people that covered. You don't touch the guys. You keep yourself covered. You wear modest clothing. You're respectful. No problem whatsoever. You know, you walk around. There's still a Marks and Spencers and Debenhams in the mall, which was a surprise to me, actually. It's like, oh, okay. this is very similar. And, you know, you take taxis everywhere, which are very, very cheap, and everyone's lovely to you. So Qatar, I loved. And even my friends in the Middle East, like, you loved Qatar. I said, I literally had no issues with Qatar at all. I actually really enjoyed my time there. Then and it was probably a good way to start because it's quite extreme. But then you go to Dubai, and as a creative in Dubai, of course, it is kind of, it's not plastic fantastic. It's golden marble, whatever. Everything's golden marble. You know, my apartment had marble floors, and you have, you know, maids and so much space and everything. You're called ma'am, and you're treated with so much respect because you're British. There's a hierarchy as your culture goes, and British top of the tree, really, when it kind of comes to hierarchy in the Middle East. And because we help build it, basically, especially Dubai. So I loved it. Again, you're not told how to act. You're not told. I wish I was. You're not told that it's male-dominated culture. I guess people think you know that, but you don't. And I'm a strong woman. So as a woman, obviously my colour didn't matter because everyone is of colour in the Middle East, whether you're Lebanese or Saudi, everyone's of colour. There were obviously lots of Europeans there, Danish and British. I think for me, the hardest battle as a creative was on two parts. One, being a woman with an opinion, because male leadership, their opinion counts. And the second thing was the clients aren't ready for what you're offering. And that, for me, is purely from a shopper marketing integrated perspective. They're still in sales promotion land to understand the science and psychology of shopper and integration. So the clients weren't ready for what you're offering. But for me, it was the most amazing experience. We got the Coke business, funnily enough, and I worked a lot with Coke. And that transformed my mind as a creative again, because, you know, they'd say, right, let's do a sampling in Iraq. And I go, okay. And I think, gosh, I know nothing about Iraq. And, so we'd have lots of meetings and speak to people in Iraq and say, well, the thing is, in Iraq, Coke was banned because it was American. So Pepsi rules, but Coke's coming in. We want to sample. You've got to get it in people's hands. But if you sample on people's doorsteps, mums won't open their doors because they think they're going to get shot in the face.
Yeah.
Or in Saudi, we want to do billboards saying it's family meal time. But if you do, you can't show women in advertising, even though it's family meal time. Okay. And in Egypt, I went to Egypt, we want to promote Nestle. You know, what's a fresh look at Nestle ice creams in Egypt when there aren't really any supermarkets, and the ones that are have power cuts every half hour, so all the freezers break down and everything melts, and so they just shove any chickens in the freezer. I loved it. That the reality of the Middle East, the religion, the politics, the poverty, the wealth, because on the other hand, you're doing Damas with beautiful diamonds and gold in billionaire land. And you're doing brands off Penelope Cruz swanning around, and you're dealing with the luxury market. Fascinating. That's where, build that on top of America, that's where I truly understood what multicultural is about, how really truly understanding your market. Do they even speak English? They're second generation, third generation. Are they immigrants? How you market to them is so different and so critically important. Loved it.
Great. Where are we now then for your path?
So at JWT, I leave JWT and come back to the UK and in 2016, summer 2016. And again, I think, okay, now is the time. You've traveled the world, Joe. Now's the time to come back to the UK. And I wasn't sure where I fit. And I saw in some of your other things that people have spoken about that. You get to a certain stage in your career and you don't know where you fit. I didn't know where I fit because of my global experience. I didn't know how to bring it here. And also because even though I'd worked on amazing brands, but the creativity is different. Because when you work into a cultural market, it's not about doing a D&AD award-winning ad. It's about making meaningful change in someone's life. And that's the difference I've learned. You know, that's the difference that I truly love. It's about doing great ideas and great work, but it's about making a meaningful change in someone's life. And you come back here when you've been away for so long, and when you look on LinkedIn and everyone's talking about multiculturalism and there aren't enough black, there aren't enough women, I'm like, oh my goodness, excuse me. When I started, I was black and I was women, and are we still having this conversation, England? Are we really still having this conversation? So that was a surprise, and how rampant it was on social media was a surprise. I mean, I got straight back in the fact that I talked at DNAD 17, and I talked about how I'd seen advertising changing and how it changed. I'm a visiting lecturer at St. Martin's, talking to students there about multiculturalism. And it's just very interesting getting back into this market. I do lots of consulting still for huge brands in the States. But I realised that for me to be happy, I mean, I could take a job tomorrow in an agency, but it's not going to make me happy. And I realised for me to be happy, I need to be able to embrace everything I've learned globally and bring it here in a meaningful way. And that's where I am right now in my life.
Yeah, I think what's been interesting in terms of everything you say is the number of times you say, I love it, when you get to a different experience and a new experience, which is fantastic. And I think that seems to be, you know, a huge part of your personality. Because I think a lot of people might go, oh my God, Qatar, or melting freezes in Egypt, or small town Arkansas, and not embrace the good and interesting and different things that are about it, but go, oh, fucking hell, I'm in small town Arkansas, where I used to, you know, go to the West End and see a play or whatever. There isn't that there, or whatever it happens to be. So it feels like to me you've got a really positive attitude about things that happen or things that are happening in your situation, and you embrace the new and different as it goes on. Do you think that's fair to say?
Absolutely. I mean, if someone had told me in Arkansas I'd come out of a play and there'd be a row of people from a church holding up signs saying women should be at home cooking, you don't go to plays, that I'd go to a gay bar, there would be a giant cross on wheels, like the size of two telephone boxes on top of each other, on wheels, a giant cross, and they would stand there outside gay bars. I would sit there going, are you kidding me? I'm Soho Joe. That's my nickname. I'm Soho Joe. Are you kidding me? But it's all in education. And I go back in time to when I was at, you know, interviewed in Gloucestershire, you know, five political questions about the world, and I couldn't answer one, let alone who the prime minister was probably at that time. I think my education through advertising has been amazing, and what I've been able to bring to advertising in return. I mean, what I've been able to bring to P&G globally, what I've been able to bring to Coca-Cola globally because of this experience, and now what I hope I can bring to the UK because of this experience. I wouldn't have wanted any other life. I never would have planned it. I never would have planned it in a million years, but for an advertising career. And I just think people now, these young kids coming into advertising, you may be very focused on your job and where you are, but realize that there's a whole world out there. And especially if you're part of a global network who can move you and hold your hand every step of the way across the world, just be very open to the world. You know, we're a connected world today. We are connected. You shouldn't think of your career as just one city. London is not, you know, it's not the center of the advertising universe. You know, you look around the world, everything is happening, and the chance to actually go there and live it and experience it. And the creatives, you as a creative director, the creators I've met, the creators I've mentored, who now I'm still in contact with 20, 30 years later, you know, we still talk. It's incredible. It's an amazing experience. I'm sure you know, being in Los Angeles.
Yeah, absolutely. But one of the things I really did want to talk to you about is that diversity thing. And I think the way you kind of dismissed it, and I think in a really good way, is like, I can't believe we're still talking about this now. It's funny because most of the people having these conversations, and either, you know, if they're putting their foot in it or they're writing an editorial about it, tend to be white, I've noticed,
yeah,
which is quite interesting. And it may be because, you know, there you know, is a lack of people of color within the industry, particularly in England. But it feels like your attitude, which is very positive about things, it's like, oh my God, come on. And you went through it in a time when it was like, you know, it wasn't even a conversation. And I wonder if that was sort of good and bad, because people were like, you know, they didn't even, it wasn't, we're all going to talk about diversity. We're all going to make sure we have a quota or something like that. You just carved your path through the 80s advertising and 90s advertising scene, and it wasn't a thing. Do you feel like it being a thing now is a good thing or a bad thing?
I'll be completely honest, and people aren't going to like me for saying it, but I think I've been a little bit verbal on LinkedIn. I see it a little bit as a bad thing, because for a few reasons. One, I see very good intentioned people saying, come on, if your skin colour's black, come on, we'll give you a placement. Because we look good, we're ticking on quotas, and we're good headhunters, or we're good agencies, and you've got a bit of talent, that's good, but, you know, you're black and, you know, we're doing the right thing. Stuffed out for a lark. Why advertising was great is because you get in because of your grit and your talent and your perseverance. I never would have wanted to have been, I would never wanted to have known that I'm sat on a seat in a meeting room because of the colour of my skin. And that puts, and that was recently discussed in the States by HR of a global network, actually. They said there's so much pressure, actually, on people from minorities being hired, and fair pressure, because they feel that they have to have a voice where they might not have one. They feel that they have to be twice as good as the white counterparts. And that isn't a way. Charity is not a way to start a career in advertising. So I think if you hire more talented people of colour, good for you, you bloody do it. And I am purely talking about colour, not the women issue. If you're doing a programme just for people of colour, that kind of makes my skin crawl a little bit. So I think everyone should get in for their, you know, be smart, be brave, find your way in. Colour is not an excuse, and you don't necessarily start from a place of disadvantagement. You know, I was on a small holding in Gloucestershire. If you're passionate about something, you'll find a way. And I know that might sound naive. You know, you say, well, we're on a council estate in Manchester. Well, if you want it, you'll find a way. When I was 15, I was ordering campaign through WH Smiths. If you're passionate, you'll find a way. So I think there's a charity element, which I don't agree with. I think more black inverted commas faces in a room is a good thing. I think the industry is getting too scared about the words diversity. I'd never even heard the word BAM till I came back. I'm like, what?
Oh, yeah.
Bloody hell's BAM. BAM's like, oh, great. You've put me in another box. I didn't know I was in that box. I spent my life ticking boxes. Now I'm in another one. Thank you so much for putting me in another box. And everyone's using that hashtag, and it's kind of, they're scared of it. It's like, yes, yes, we understand diversity because we all let, it's Diwali, and so we all let an Indian meal. I'm going, well, great. I'm sure your agency really learnt from that. That's great. And this is where I am. Where I am is the more people of colour in a room in advertising, the better. How they get there, I don't necessarily agree with the methods going on now. I think the clients are desperate, and I know because I've reached out to clients objectively to ask for their opinions, are desperate for multicultural representation, true experts. You see, just because you're black doesn't mean you know how to do multicultural advertising. Just because you're black, just because you're Asian, doesn't mean to say you know how to market to a second generation Pakistani family in Hull. Or you know the difference between a Muslim family in Manchester. So colour of skin doesn't mean you're an expert. And I think the industry's been very naive in cutting up their quotas of colour. They think that's expertise, and it isn't. So I think we need more people of colour who have expertise, who understand how to market to multicultural consumers, which are huge. The opportunity out there business-wise is huge. And that's the stage where I'm at now, if I've got anything, I guess, to kind of close-ish down on, is I'm about, not about, my mission isn't get more people of colour in. It's great, get more people of colour in, fine. But how are we talking to these people of colour who feel they're not represented, who feel agencies are ignoring them? I mean, if I see another multicultural black-white family, it might blow my mind. Everyone thinks, cool, we put a mixed-race family in, that's good, we've done our job. Oh, we've had a cultural collage, I call them, a sofa ad. Oh, we've had a cultural collage. Cool, we've ticked our boxes. But how is that really speaking to a third-generation Polish person in, you know, Liverpool? We're not going deep enough, and we're going deep. Britain isn't looking at itself as a region as we are in the rest of the world. So where I am now, and it's a very profitable business. You know, Asians are the fastest growing middle class, and they actually stand for half of all new UK millionaires. Ethnic spending power is like estimated at 90 billion a year. So I'm looking at multiculturalism as a business, and through that you will grow and keep, you know, expert people of colour in the industry. But I just think we need to just kind of all calm down a bit.
That's great.
Sorry, did I talk?
No, that's really good. And I think the funny thing is about that very last thing you said, you know, we talk about multiculturalism and, you know, people's minds go to a certain place immediately and they're going, oh, you know, we should have more people of colour in agencies, and that's going to be a good thing. But a lot of demographics are just completely ignored in that, because people's minds might go to Afro-Caribbean people or something like that, and they might not go, hang on, do we have enough people from Asia represented in ad agencies? Because I really don't know that many people of that background either who are in, say, creative departments. But, you know, it feels like people have an opinion about what they're talking about. And also, when I wrote a blog post about this a few months ago, but, you know, we talk about multicultural diversity, and then there's gender representation as well, and then then LGBTQ as well. You know, that's harder, because, you know, we probably don't even know everyone who might be gay or of that background in an ad agency already. And then there's ageism as well, and that's the one that dare not speak its name, because it almost looks like, hey, you had a good run in the ad industry, why should we have sympathy for you, why should we be trying to help you? But then the ad industry is losing a lot of people of those backgrounds, because it's not looking like it's necessarily an open door to certain people in certain situations. You know, if you're the amount of great talent of a certain age, and I'd put that, say, above 40 and definitely above 50, that's gone from the industry now is ridiculous. And that's not really getting talked about either, because it's not quite so, God, I'm trying to think of the right word here, trendy, or I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I can't fight every cause. I think what I've learned is to fight what I believe in, and multiculturalism is what I believe in. And if I bring in more women, more other people of other genders through doing that, brilliant. But my personal fight is the multicultural fight. If that's what people are talking about now, I want to say, then do it right. Let's just do it right. It isn't about hiring people. It's how you actually talk to people. So I'm working with a couple of global networks right now and seeing how possibly we could fix that, because, you know, I'm also about the business. I am old enough to know it's about the business, and the money being lost not marketing to these brands in mainstream advertising when people want to see themselves in the story of a brand. They just want to fit, and big brands are making huge cultural mistakes. You know, you only have to look at Dove and H&M this week, for heaven's sake. So that's the bit I want to fix. I don't think, you know, I think you've got to find your place. And I think I am at that stage now. I've had a long career, as you said, and I'm not going to be happy going back into an ordinary, in inverted commas, job. I want to do a job where I feel everything I've learned can come together, and that's where I am. And it's relevant.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, I think we've covered most things there, unless there was anything else you wanted to talk about or say.
No, not at all. Okay. Not at all. I think it's been great. And I think advertising, where it's going, of course, with, you know, digital technology and AI, et cetera, et cetera. Who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? Who knows what's going to happen next week? And what an exciting place to be. Incredible. I think the industry is an exciting place. I think let's get back to creativity. Balance it with the technology.
Yeah.
And have real conversations, because we're a global world now.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely where we are. Huge thanks for that. I'll put up the relevant links and things on the blog post that goes with this, and I'll email you about some of the other stuff we discussed. And huge thanks for your time, Jo.
Thanks, matey, so much. Let's stay in touch.
Yeah. Okay. Cheers, Jo. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
If this is a podcast, then what's Christmas?